RadioInfluence.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tennis with an Accent podcast. This is Saqib, your co-host. This podcast is brought to you in partnership with RadioInfluence.com. Today, I have a special guest on the podcast, Scoop Malinowski. I got to know him personally while covering the Miami Open the last 2 years. Scoop is a kind of fountain of tennis stats and, you know, tidbits. And let's talk about him and his work and, you know, what he's up to. Hey, Scoop, how are you?
Hi, Saqib. Doing great. Thanks for inviting me. Hello, everybody.
So I know, you know, plenty about you, but, you know, what have you been up to? Just give an idea of the body of work that you've created by writing some of these books and, you know, the tennis tournaments you cover. Just give an intro.
Okay, the first tennis book, well, I've been covering tennis, writing about tennis for different publications, websites since the 90s, Tennis Week magazine, tennisweek.com, Tennis Magazine Australia, Ace Magazine of London, some for the ATP World Tour website. I started a tennis site, tennis-pros.com, about 10 years ago, and I've also written 6 tennis books. The first one I did was on Marcelo Rios 5 years ago. Marcelo Rios, the man we barely knew. Then after that, I got some pretty good feedback on that. Some people liked it. It didn't sell so great, but I felt it was a book that needed to be done because Marcelo Rios was a very important player in tennis history. Should not be forgotten. And I got some positive feedback on that, which inspired me to do a book on Federer in a similar format of collecting memories and anecdotes and stories about what it's like to play Federer. So then I did Facing Federer. That got some positive reviews by Tennis Magazine. Steve Tigner called it addictive reading. Then it's really enjoyable to do that, to do those books, and I just kept doing them. I've done Facing Nadal, Facing Hewitt, Facing McEnroe, Facing Sampras. And I hope I'm not forgetting one. And then the latest one has been Facing Safin. And I'm also working right now on pretty close to finishing a double book of Facing Steffi Graf and Facing Serena Williams. And I don't have quite enough on both players. It's hard to get a lot of interviews with players who actually played Steffi. They're just not around that yet. It's hard to, you know, at the tournaments, there's just not many players around who have played Steffi. So but I've got about 20 interviews and 20 on Serena. So I'm about to do a double book. Should be ready early next year, Facing Steffi and Facing Serena.
Yeah, that'll be nice. That was my question. You know, what about the women books? But you answered it before even I got to ask that. So before we get into the, you know, the meaty part of these books, you've been covering a lot of tournaments. I'm a rookie. I've only covered like 6 or 7 tournaments, and I've met you on 4 of those instances, Rhode Island and twice in Miami. So what are some of the favorite stops for you, and how many tournaments have you covered in your, you know, writing career?
I don't keep statistical information on that like you do, but Miami Open is one of the favorites. Newport is definitely one of the favorites. We saw each other. We saw you there this year and last year too, I think.
Yeah, I was there last year. Yeah.
Not this year then. U.S. Open, of course, is always just a gigantic. It's like a Super Bowl 2 week party of tennis. Even some challenges too. Sarasota Open Challenger I've covered about 4 years in 3 different locations in Sarasota. The Washington D.C. tournament is also a great tournament. Really nice location. Really nice tournament. I think that's about it at the top of my head. I've been to Wimbledon twice. Look forward to someday covering Monte Carlo, Cincinnati, Montreal. As many as I can. You know, every pro tournament, as you know, I've noticed, probably they're all different. They're all special in their own way. They're all really neat.
How has the press room changed, in your opinion? You know, going back to the earlier generations, like when Sampras was playing, or you know, Marat Safin was in the at the press booth. How has it changed now in the Federer-Nadal era? What are some of the nuances that, you know, people know, but you know, it's hard to nitpick when you see these interviews because they all seem pretty routine.
First thing that pops in my head is actually I've been first went to the U.S. Open in I think 92 or 93, and I remember the press room was upstairs, then there was the interview room all the way down, it was pretty full. You had to go up and down the elevator, and I remember it was hot and cold. It was hot outside, and the interview room was cold, and the press room was cold, and I ended up getting sick, I think, in the first or second year I was there. So it wasn't as convenient back then as it is now. That was the old press room, interview room in Ash Stadium, Armstrong Stadium. Very crowded back then, I remember. It wasn't. Now there's much more media space. Everything's much more comfortable and convenient. So convenient now that a lot of the reporters never even leave the media center. Some of them, like I'd say 90% of them, stay in there the whole time. They watch on the monitors and they do the interviews in the interview rooms, and most of them never see them out there watching any matches.
Yeah, I'm talking to one of my good friends, Mert Ertunga, and he says the same thing when he covers Roland Garros for one of the Turkish websites. He said a lot of media personnel are just in the media room and they are really not going to look out for stories, because I guess monitors are there and you can pick a match, you choose to watch. But again, I guess that's another, new change, maybe. I've never been to tournaments before. I've only been as fan and only entered the realm with a media pass last year. But I still like to go and watch a match. Like in Miami, I wanted to watch certain matches. I got to watch Shapovalov, Khachanov, and some of those players courtside, and that was a great experience. And then got to talk about them and ask them questions. So let's switch to Rios. I know this year in Miami.
Boy, you made me think of something. I want to tell how important it is to be out there at the courts, actually watching the matches. You see things when you're at the court watching the live matches. You see things that you don't see on TV. Like one year I was watching Pays and Stepanek playing doubles. It was the year in Miami, a few months after they won the Australian Open together, and they beat the Bryans in Australia, and then they were playing the Bryans again on court one outside the stadium around 5-6 o'clock at night. Great match, just a great, great tennis to watch those two teams go at it. The Bryans, I think Paige Stepanek won the first set, and they were down a break in the second. They came back and tied it, then they went up to break. Obviously incredible tennis. And then they came over in the changeover, and I was sitting right behind their seats in the changeover box, right behind Pays and Stepanek, next to their coach, Rick Leach. Rick Leach was coaching Pays at the time. And they came and sat in the changeover, all pumped up, all psyched up. They're up a set and a break on the Bryans for the about to beat them for the second time that year. It's about 5 or 6 years ago. And all of a sudden, Stepanek was on the right chair, and then Paige was on the left chair, and Stepanek leaned over and said, "I love you," to Paige. And then Paige reached up with his hand and kissed him on the forehead. You wouldn't believe it, but it really, really happened. I swear to God, I didn't dream that. I actually witnessed that. He actually said, "I love you." They're up a set and a break in the Miami Open.
It's so funny that you say something like this, because a lot of times doubles is not captured. And if it's an outside court, forget it. They might show a match point or, just to fill in, some of the timing slots, even for, some of the good singles matches. And I have a similar story. Again, it was not a good story, but we watched Sania Mirza and Martina Hingis at the U.S. Open, I think, 3 years ago when they were, in their historic run as a team. And they easily won, I think, their second round match against some young team. And the scoreline was pretty routine. So I guess Hingis and Mirza went up to the players and asked them if they, because I guess both teams have to leave with the security. So they asked the players if they don't mind sitting for 10 more minutes, and they wanted to hit. And I found it very disrespectful. The other players agreed. Hingis and Mirza were hitting singles after winning a doubles match in less than 50 minutes. And, these things will never make it out. And I'm a great fan of Martina Hingis. And I come from the land of Sania Mirza. But, it just rubbed me the wrong way. Maybe these things happen. But, I've been going to the Open for like close to 18 years. I've never seen something like that. So, yeah. a lot of times courtside, you do hear a lot. And even this year, the U.S. Open, I was watching the Luca Pui match. And when Pui challenged, I think the chair umpire said, "Mr. Goffin is challenging." And Pui looked at him and just shrugged his shoulder. What, you forgot my name? This is only the third set of the match. And the chair apologized. So, yeah, you definitely catch a lot of these things that you don't catch, on TV. So I know this year in Miami, I met you and, you know, we spoke at length when you presented the book to Yoshito Nishioka because he's a big Marcelo Rios fan. So let's talk about Rios. What made you write this book? Because he's still considered one of the most talented guys, but he's not a well-liked guy. And a lot of the impression, the narrative that follows him is that he's, you know, he's a badass. So what do you think? Were the reasons? Of course, he's one of the most talented guys ever to pick a racket. I'm a big fan. But what were your reasons to bringing his story to life? And these books, you do go around the tour and ask the opponents and coaches and media personnel what their memories are of this particular player. So just walk us through, you know, how the Rios book started.
Okay, I remember distinctly how it started. It was, I was doing a biofile with Thomas Johansson, and I asked him a funny memory in his career. And he said that his funny memory was when he was playing, he was at the Rome Open, and it was a press conference of Marcelo Rios, and they asked him about what it was going to be, what was he expecting when he was playing Thomas Muster in the next round. And Rios said, he'll be lucky. Muster will be lucky if he wins one or two games off me. And then he actually said that. And then Johansson was, and this is an Australian Open champion talking, Johansson was shocked and awed that Rios actually did beat Muster by just about that score. He just totally destroyed Muster. And he was in awe of Rios because he said, you know, his experiences playing Rios were also quite humbling too. He said, you could be playing great tennis and you could play Rios, and he said his exact quote was, he could make you feel like a beginner. And that story, it just came up in the Thomas Johansson biofile, and it really sparked me to, and this is right around the time he retired. He suddenly left tennis, I think he was 29 years old, 2003, and it sparked me to, he just retired, and maybe I should do an article about Rios and ask a few more players about their memories of what it was like playing Rios or practicing with Rios, and then, you know, just do like a little tribute article. And I did. And I remember the second person I went up to, actually, I think it was later that day, it was at the US Open in the hallway of Ash Stadium, and Jimmy Aris was walking by. And I just said, hey, Jimmy, do you happen to have a memory of Marcelo Rios? And he also had a interesting memory too, only practicing with him. He said, he was called by Nick Bollettieri to come and practice with Rios after Wimbledon, when Rios was like number two in the world. He lost early in Wimbledon that year, and he went back to Bradenton, Florida, and was training at IMG, but nobody was there because everybody was at Wimbledon. So Bollettieri had to call up Arias to come and practice with Rios. Arias said that he actually won the practice set off him that day. And he kind of said he liked to throw little jabs at the players. He said, hey, so Marcelo, if I was playing today, if I wasn't retired, what would I be, like three or four in the world? And then he said Rios got annoyed by that. He said, I'm going to kick your ass tomorrow. And then they practiced again the next day. And he said, yeah, wow, Rios was playing incredible. It was unbelievable how he was playing, like the first three, four games. He was, you know, I saw Rios at full flight. You know, and he said he could hit the ball, and like all of a sudden with the same stroke, the exact same stroke, his shot would come at you like 20 miles an hour faster. He just had a special, bizarre talent. So that was a really neat story too about Rios. And so that's two for two. And I just kept on doing it. And it seemed like everybody I asked about Rios for their stories about Rios was just as interesting and just in a different way. And the article ended up being published freelance by Tennis Week magazine. And a lot of people really liked it and got very positive feedback on it. And I figured, you know, 15, 20 interviews with players, let me go for like 50, 75. Maybe I could do a book out of this. And that's what happened.
So you didn't get to speak with Agassi because there was no love lost between these two guys. What I remember, especially back in the day, the rivalry was pretty intense. They didn't play a lot, but I think Rios did get the better of Agassi in a couple of key matches. What was his impression coming through some of the contemporaries, like especially American guys? Did you get a chance to speak with any of the Courier, Chang, Sampras generation guys?
Well, I did get to speak with Brad Gilbert about Rios, and I didn't get to speak with Agassi, but Gilbert told me that match they played, the first time they played, was the Miami Open final. And you know, as everybody probably remembers, that Rios won that match in straight sets.
Yeah, 7-5, 6-4, 6-3. Yeah, I remember that.
Rios, it was an unbelievable display. You know, some people call it like the best tennis they've saw the decade, some of the best tennis play of that decade. And Rios became number one in the world, and there were some questions about Rios around that time because months earlier he lost to Peter Corda in the final of the Australian Open, 6-2, 6-2, 6-2. So there was kind of questions about Rios, if he was a choker, if he had what it took to, would he be able to handle the pressure of playing a revitalized Agassi for number one in the world? You know, and there was a lot at stake for Rios in that match. I found out later that he earned 2.5 million bonuses from Nike and 2.5 million bonus from Yonex for that, for becoming number one in the world that match, on top of the prize money. And so it was a huge match for Rios, and he came up with the magical tennis that day, and he beat Agassi. And Brad Gilbert, I asked Brad Gilbert about that, and he said the first thing Agassi told him when he came in the locker room after the match was, I thought I played really good. And he did. And Gilbert was like, yeah, the talent, what he showed that day, he had the talent to win five majors. And then I put the quotes in, I researched the quotes that Agassi said after the match in Miami. And I put that in, that's all I have about what Agassi said, but it's quite interesting. You know, he thought he was playing really good, but you know, Rios was just on a different level. Rios, for some reason, got extra inspired to play Agassi. He played him again later that year in a Grand Slam Cup for another million-dollar match, the final, the Grand Slam Cup, the five-setter in Germany, and Rios won that one in five sets. So he was 2-0 against Agassi the first two times he played him.
And yeah, I remember those matches. So, Scoop, let me ask you this, because in your books, you also, you know, cross-interview a lot of fellow media members. And what my memory of Rios is, as talented as he was very short with the media. Maybe it was a language, or he just chose to stay aloof. And he was a man of few words, and he made some comments throughout, which, you know, went along with his persona. First of all, what's your recollection in this book, how media perceived him? And then is there any player in today's game that's closest to Rios in his media demeanor?
Oh, Rios, I might even say he hated the media. He really, really resented the media. I tried to track it down, what was the root of that, and I talked to some Chilean journalists, and he apparently got some bad press early in his career, even in his junior career. I don't know the details about it, but he got bad press in Chile, and it just triggered him to really not trust and dislike the media. He had no respect for the media. Actually, one player actually told me that he saw the media as parasites, you know, kind of living off his talent. And he didn't trust the media. Maybe Rios had a vision of the media being fake news media way ahead of everybody else. Who knows? But he just never... You know, he would never give the media anything. You know, he really held back. And then I remember I approached him one time at the U.S. Open. Hey, Marcelo, can I do this quick biofile interview with you? And he wouldn't even look at me, and just like walked by. And then one time I tried to, after one of his matches at U.S. Open, I went into the press conference in main interview room one, to try to do a biofile with him that way, you know, just ask him the questions from out they have that set up in the audience. And there was only one other reporter there. And I tried to do a biofile with him that way. And I said, hey, Marcelo, who are your childhood heroes? Because I don't remember. I didn't have any. No, he said, I didn't have any. And I said, what's the greatest moment of your career? He goes, oh, I don't remember. He said, how about your favorite movies? He goes, why are you asking me questions like that? No, you couldn't get him. You couldn't get him to cooperate. He was very, very uncooperative. Maybe private, maybe very shy. He just didn't care for the obligations that the players have with the media, or the tennis establishment. Just could not, convince him to do it. But it's a strange guy.
Is there anyone in the game today who could be the modern version of Rios when it comes to press? My vote is Fognini, but you've been around longer. Is there anyone who's very short with media?
Yeah, Fognini. Fognini's close. He's close. I see some influence of Rios on Fognini. So, you know, the way he swaggers around the court with the cocky arrogance sometimes, and he can play that real artistic game, real nice game to watch. Yeah, I see some similarity there. Other than that, no, man. You know, most of the players are really, really nice, really cooperative, and I think that's a credit to the influence that Federer and Nadal and Djokovic and Murray have had on the game. They've always been really, really cooperative, friendly, and nice with the media. And I think they set the tone, and the rest of the players follow it.
Sure. So one more question on Rios before we switch to Marat Safin. So when you finish this book, you know, in collection of, you know, a lot of information about Rios coming through different players and media, did you uncover something that you didn't know about the man? He's pretty shy or, you know, or arrogant, whatever adjectives you use. But did you learn something that a lot of people didn't know about the man?
A lot, yeah, because he was a mystery man, a mystery character. But that's a hard question because I did the book about 6-7 years ago. But if anything, I'd say that, yeah, okay. I'd say maybe the most interesting thing that pops in my mind was he was coached by Peter Lundgren for a while, and he abruptly parted ways with Lundgren. I guess he mistreated him, and you know, Rios was like that with some of his coaches. He just, as some of the players are, they just get rid of the coaches quickly and randomly, and you don't even understand the reason. Like, he parted ways with Larry Stefanke shortly after he became number one in the world. And so I talked to Peter Lundgren in Miami about 7-8 years ago about Rios, and he said Rios actually came up to him and took him aside and apologized to him for the way he treated him. So that was pretty shocking to hear that Rios had that quality in him to apologize. He did a lot of nasty, Ilie Nastasi called him the worst prick I ever met. And a lot of players felt, Roy Emerson went up to Marcelo Rios to try to talk with him one time in the U.S. Open in the locker room after a match, just to, you know, have a conversation with him. And Rios didn't even know who he was, and he said, "Who the F are you?" to Roy Emerson. And Patrick Rafter witnessed that right there, and he made Rios apologize to Roy Emerson. So to hear that Rios actually would take a former coach who he fired and apologize to him for the way he treated him was pretty surprising.
So Peter Lundgren seems to be a common link for your books because he's coached three of the most talented players, you know, in the last 20 years, Rios, Federer, and Safin. So let's talk about the book that just came out, Facing Marat Safin. Again, a very intriguing character. What were your reasons to choose this book while there are so many other good players who are playing? And I'm sure you can still write about the other players. So what is about Safin that, you know, made you write the book? And after writing the book, what have you uncovered about the man that you didn't know going in?
Well, Safin, of course, is another incredible super talent and also a super colorful character. And there are no other books written about him. So I figured to apply the same formula to do a book on Safin. I don't think Safin is the kind of guy who would ever think of doing a book. Kind of a private guy, actually a shy guy, as one source told me. He's pretty shy, actually, until he gets to know the people around him. I just think another one of the greatest players in tennis history when he was playing at his best and should not be forgotten. I think, and a lot of people still love him and think he's super worthy of any kind of book being written about him. And I'll read a little excerpt. I have a little excerpt here, maybe captures his essence. This was pretty surprising what I read about him. It's from Thomas Johansson. I interviewed Thomas Johansson Miami this year, and here's what he said. He was talking about their famous 2002 Australian Open final, which Johansson won. He said he was playing like the best tennis of his life, and he won it in four sets against Safin, who was pretty heavily favored in that match. And so Thomas Johansson said, "That match, 2002 Australian Open final, was probably one of my best matches ever under the circumstances. It was my first Grand Slam final, and I had played very good tennis the whole, especially the last week. I played very well. But I was also very nervous going into the final because it was not every day that you play a Grand Slam final, and especially against Marat. So nervous going in, but after the first set, the tension, I released the tension, and I started to play like I did the previous day in the semifinal. And I think the tiebreaker in the fourth set was probably my best tennis ever. but Murat is very, very good friend of mine. I like him a lot. He has the biggest heart among all my friends, I think. We actually spent 10 days with him in Dinara in the off season in Monte Carlo together with Maria Sakkari, who Johansson coaches this year and who I'm coaching here at the Miami Open. And this was last year in December where they had like a little training camp together. And Thomas said, we had so much fun and I hadn't seen Murat in such a long time. And it was very nice to catch up with him. And he's such a nice guy. And he said that Murat and Safina actually hit with Sakkari like nine days in a row and gave her a lot of tips and advices. Yeah, and I was surprised to hear that story.
That's a good one. So in your process, did you get a chance to talk with some of Safin's coaches like Hernan Gumi, Alexander Volkov, or people who work with him? Because I followed his career as a fan, you know, and a big fan here. A lot of times, I think the common narrative, especially through the ESPN windmill, was that Safin is not serious. And I remember Safin saying a long time ago that, you know, these are some of the most insulting things he hear, that, you know, he didn't work hard. He said, without working hard, you can't reach number one. Of course, there's always a counter argument that he could have won more. He's, again, like Rio's one of the guys who pretty much, I think, left a lot out there. But I guess that's their personality and that's how, you know, they worked. So while you gathered all this information about Safin, did you encounter some of the myths about his work ethic?
I only interviewed one coach off the top of my head. It was Bar Sobkin, who was during his teenage years. I never came across Gumi and didn't have the chance to interview Mats and Lundgren. I haven't seen Lundgren around in about 3-4 years. So I got Sobkin, which was really interesting. He has memories of Murat way back in the early days, before he was sent to Spain to train. Sobkin, interestingly, thinks that that whole experience being sent to Spain it stunted his growth. It did not make him a better player. He said before he went to Spain, Safin was more of an attacking player, and he was very good at it. And when he went to Spain, he became more of a baseline player. So he, Bar Sobkin is one of the most underrated great coaches in the sport. Working with Eugenie from age, I believe, 10 to 37 now. And then now that Eugenie has just retired, and that's maybe the longest one coach has worked with one player. Started him. He actually created and built him as a player at age 10 to become a top player. But Safin's the question about Safin was the love for the tennis. It was a question of, did he really love tennis, or was he more pushed into it by especially his mom and his dad, but especially the mom? But still, he became number one in the world and was the best player in the world, especially when he showed against Pete Sampras in the U.S. Open. So there must have been some love there, but maybe he's one of these guys that, the tour is a tough life. It's a you lose your freedom. You almost become kind of like a puppet almost to the sport, a slave to the sport, some people would say. And maybe Safin just couldn't handle that and didn't like that part of it.
Do you ever see Safin becoming a coach and returning to the tour? You see him leading that kind of life? You never say never, but what's your view?
No. He did help Sakkari for 9 days in a row. He does help the other young Russians. I interviewed Fernando Vicente, who works with Khachanov and Rublev. And he said Safin came and helped those guys in Monte Carlo in the off season or for a few days. So he does like helping players. He helped Donskoy. One of the best parts of the book is Evgeny Donskoy's memories of he wasn't his official coach, but Donskoy would email and ask Safin questions and about other players and tactics. And Donskoy said, actually, he won his very first professional challenger title because of Safin's advice for each match. And that's detailed in the book. It's one of the best parts of the book. I just don't think Safin is the kind of guy to commit to being a coach. He's such a gigantic character. If he did coach a player, he would almost upstage the player. McEnroe upstages the players. McEnroe has tried coaching Bruguera and Philippoussis and Raonic, but he hasn't had much success with any of them. I don't even know if Safin would want to commit to one player like that. I think he likes being free most of all. But Sampras, Pete Sampras, we all thought Pete Sampras would never coach, and he still hasn't coached. But I remember seeing an interview with him where he said he would not rule out coaching a player at some point in the future. So you never know.
Yeah, you know, these are funny experiences, how one views a player, because I followed my entire tennis life started with the following of Boris Becker, and I never thought as a young man that Boris Becker would be a good coach. And I still think, you know, his partnership with Djokovic is legendary, but Marin Vajda was the X factor that, you know, a lot of people don't talk about, at least didn't talk about it during that phase. But yeah, going back to Safin, did you get to talk with some of his contemporaries, other contemporaries like Cureton, Roddick, or Blake, anyone from that era?
Cureton and Roddick, Cureton and Blake, yes, definitely. Roddick didn't respond to email, but yeah, Cureton was really, really interesting. He played him 7 times, and he lost to him the first 3 times. He really respected Safin. He said, he goes, one of the sad parts about becoming number one was the fact that I took the number one away from him. He actually expressed a slight degree of sadness that, you know, that he took number one away from Safin. He really felt Safin deserved it also. You know, they played that big match in the Hamburg final, the 5-setter, and he had lost to him the 3 times he played him before that. But he said in that Hamburg final, which ended up being the key to determining the number one ranking, he said that he figured out a way to beat Safin was he started slicing and, you know, playing. He said the better you play against him, the harder you hit, the better he plays. When you kind of play worse tennis, you know, using spins and junk, it turned the rivalry around. He and Cureton won that match, and then he won the next 3 times they played. So maybe Fabrice Santoro was following that, and maybe that's why he had so much success against Safin. But
yeah, I think I was going to say that. And I think in Safin's career, another underrated part is, which people forget, he was very decent on clay. And some of his wins on clay against Ferrero, when Ferrero was playing or about to blossom into the player he became, they had some great battles in Valencia and Hamburg. And Safin did beat Guga Cureton at Roland Garros and at Hamburg. So yeah, Safin could play on clay, but I think post 2004 is where his knee gave in, and you know, he did win one major after that, the 2005 Australian Open. He became half the player, I think, movement wise. Otherwise, his games, especially his matches on clay against the Mentilla match and some of the matches he played in Nalbandian, are, I mean, I'll encourage the listeners to go and check it out. I mean, he was sublime for a big guy, the way he moved in clay. And too bad, you know, like he doesn't have much of a Roland Garros resume. He didn't make the second week 3 or 4 times and reach 1 semis. But for his a player of his caliber, I think his overall clay resume looks little bleak.
Boy, B. Cureton is defending champion, you know, and, you know, Leighton Hewitt is also considered, his resume on clay is considered weak too. But he, don't forget, a lot of people forget, he beat Cureton in Brazil, I believe, in a 5-setter in Davis Cup, which is an amazing result. So yeah, Safin has some amazing results on clay, but a lot of poor results also. Like the match against Felix Mantilla. Was that Felix Mantilla when he pulled his shorts down?
Yeah, he won the 5th set, I think, 10-8 or something. That's 2004. And then I think he had blisters, and then he was accused in the same tournament for gamesmanship because he was playing Potito Starace, the Italian. And then Safin called, you know, he was one of the most fair players, I think. And before Federer, he's the last man to win ATP's fan favorite award. So Safin was really upset, I remember, with the Paris press, and he showed blisters. He took the band-aid off and showed, you know, how bloody his hands were. And I think that was the reason, one of the big reasons why he lost to Nalbandian, because in the 4th round in Roland Garros that year, because before going to that match, Safin had a commanding 4-1 or 5-1 head-to-head against David Nalbandian. And you know how the draw works out. Cureton was coming back after hip surgery, and had Safin gone through Nalbandian, his next match was Cureton, and then Gaston Gaudio, against who he had a winning record. Who knows how that fortnight could have transpired. Again, I'm, as a fan, I still have that memory, because in Korea, again, was cramping and choking in the finals. So that's from 4th round, for Safin's point of view, you know, I felt that one is, you know, that one could have more twists if he didn't have the blisters. And that's when he was with Peter Lundgren, you know, starting to play some good tennis again. Again, that's my memory. Again, you know, like, I followed the guy very closely on Tennis Channel and reading a lot of interviews. So I'm really glad that you wrote this book, and I'm going to get this book soon. I haven't got it yet, but yeah, looking forward to, you know, reading all the commentary on Safin's.
Oh, thank you very much, Zach. Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. I think any Safin fan or any tennis fan will enjoy it. There's a lot of cool, interesting inside information in there. It was a blast to do it. I laughed. I sometimes laughed so hard I got a tear in my eye hearing some of these stories. And I interviewed the racket technician guy who worked for Safin, and his perspective is pretty interesting too. He ended up getting fired. But so many high points in the process of doing this book. I wish I could have done 100 more interviews, but who knows what else I could have learned.
So what's next besides the Serena Williams Steffi Graf book? Are you looking at Djokovic? What are some of the other subjects out there that you want to maybe introduce the same book with their name?
Facing Andy Murray at some point, facing Djokovic at some point, facing Rod Laver would be pretty interesting, I think. Maybe facing Connors, facing Agassi, anything.
Maybe facing Kyrgios one day.
Gonzalez, who?
Nick Kyrgios?
If he gets his head on straight. If he becomes a serious player, but I don't know how insightful that will be to interview a bunch of players who played against a guy who tanks too many of his matches.
All right, Scope. So I think we covered quite a lot, and thanks for doing this. I know you are a busy guy. So yeah, everyone who's listening, you can look for these books on Amazon. The book is called Facing Murat Safin, Facing Roger Federer, and so on. Facing John McEnroe, Facing Rafael Nadal. So Scope, again, it was a pleasure. As always, hope to run into you in Miami Open next year.
Thank you very much, Saqib. Yeah, it was a great pleasure. Fun talking to you, and yeah, look forward to seeing you soon.
I'm Jerry Petuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.